This episode of Literary Treks is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform for creating a blog, website, portfolio, or an online store. To create your own space, visit squarespace.com and save 10% by using offer code TREK12. And by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Plus, if you'd like to support our programming personally, visit trek.fm/donate to get our alien badges and art prints featuring original illustration by Tobu Ushi.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Are you taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Literary Treks, our Star Trek books and comics show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me once again, as he is every single week from Dallas, Texas, is Matthew Rushing. Matthew, we're doing a little flip thing here. We had a time zone. It's like a temporal distortion today between America and the UK and Japan. You got to talk to James Swallow as I was snoozing over here in Japan. How'd that go?
Chris, it went great. Had fun, as everybody's going to hear in the interview. And it was a blast. I love getting to talk to James. Honestly, the other side of the page we have is always epic. James is great. I think we talked an extra 30 minutes or so about all sorts of things afterwards. And so I think, you know, this being the last episode of the year, 2013, I think everybody's really going to enjoy it. We got a great show for you, so definitely time to sit back. I mean, relax, grab a cup of hot cocoa or coffee or scotch or something, and just enjoy it, because this is going to be a rip-roaring episode.
How about a double-shot eggnog?
Well, you could do that, Chris. I don't personally like eggnog, but, you know, if somebody were to put enough booze in it, I might try it.
I think the trick to eggnog is it's two parts rum, one part eggnog.
There you go. See, that might actually make it stomachable.
All right. Well, yeah, we are all getting into the holiday mood here as the year winds down. And we have a little bit of Star Trek book news left for you this year. And the first one is, as our colleague from Earl Grey, Philip Gilfus, would say, it's time for us to judge a book by its cover, Matthew, because we have a peek at the cover for No Time Like the Past.
That's right. We sure do, Chris. And, you know, as anyone might remember, we have talked about this before. This is going to be the Greg Cox novel that joins Seven of Nine with our intrepid captain, James C. Kirk. Now, I cannot think of a more bodacious Borg for him to meet than Seven of Nine. In fact, does this kind of screw with continuity somehow, the fact that Kirk has met a Borg?
Oh, I'm sure it does. And as we just did on the Ready Room this week, we did Relativity. We know Seven is all about effing with time. So no surprise that she's here.
Well, it's not. So this is going to be really interesting. Kirk's going to be on a diplomatic mission. He's going to find himself with an unexpected ally in a dangerous situation, Annika Seven. Apparently, she's related to Gary Seven at this point.
I think so. Must be his daughter, maybe?
Yeah, something like that, which, wow, did he have a hot daughter or what? Seven had been taken apart in apparently some sort of archaeological expedition, an obscure planetoid in the Delta Quadrant. And the details really aren't important. The biggest detail is that Seven and Captain Kirk meet, which I wonder what move he's going to put on her, because I feel like Captain Kirk wouldn't pass up an opportunity to sleep with something quite so beautiful.
Well, I noticed your choice of words when you were describing what's going to happen in the book a moment ago. Instead of saying that this book brings together Captain Kirk and Seven of Nine, you said it joins them.
Yes, yes, I did. I did say join. I did mean that on purpose. It's somewhat of a merging, some you might say, if you know what I mean.
I have a feeling that if Greg Cox, who is writing this book, is listening to the show right now, he's probably thinking, I don't think I'm going to do an interview with those guys about this book.
Hopefully Greg will be back. I mean, we have gotten to talk to Greg, and it was great to talk to him. So, but no, in all seriousness, this is a mind-blowingly interesting idea to merge somebody like Seven with Kirk. And, you know, nobody does, I think, these kind of time travel stories better than Greg. And so I am looking forward to reading this a lot.
I will say also bringing these two together, it should be very interesting because they're both very, very strong-willed people. They're both intelligent characters, and they're both very strong-willed characters. And I don't know exactly how Greg is going to spin the interaction between them, but they're both great characters to work with, and I do think it'll be very, very interesting.
And the next one, Chris, is really exciting. We finally got the blurb for One Constant Star, which is David R. George III's Star Trek book, which is going to be taking place in the Lost era. Now, we do know from the blurb now it is going to be about the Enterprise B, and apparently Captain D'Amora Sulu.
That's right. It's going to be all about Yuki Sulu's niece, who is now a captain, if we tie it into ongoing.
That's true. I just caught that. I was like, okay, yeah. Oh, yep. Yeah. So Yuki Sulu is kind of like the Tasha Yar of that universe. So she's going to cross over to this one and have a child with...
Now, D'Amora is Hikaru Sulu's daughter, right? And Yuki is his sister. So this would be Yuki's niece.
Ah, okay. Okay, got it. Yeah, so this is going to be really interesting. It's going to involve D'Amora Sulu as being the captain of the Enterprise, and then John Harriman, who used to be the captain, is going to be involved in an incident with the Zencathy, and he's going to have to go and recover his former crewmate who gets into trouble. And so this looks fantastic. I love this era because there's so much you can do with it, because there's so much we don't know.
Well, and you're a big Harriman fan as well.
You know, I was. We read the comic with him. I thought he was great. I think they did the character well there. I'd like to go back and read the Lost Era book that already had Harriman in. I haven't got a chance to do that yet. And so I think it's great to have this character back. I think it's really interesting, and I can't wait to see why it was that he stepped down from command. Obviously had D'Amora take over as captain, which is pretty interesting that we have two Sulus, both captains of Excelsior-class vessels.
That's right. I think that might cause some sort of rip in space-time.
Let's hope not. I mean, and luckily it probably won't, just because the 24th century does exist in the novel. So if it does, probably just fly the TARDIS in, fix that all up, and fly back out. It'll be fine.
That sounds like a good plan to me. All right. Well, it should be interesting, and it's nice, again, to get these books that focus on characters that are not the main characters from the series, but are other characters that we are familiar with in another capacity and flesh out their stories a bit. So looking forward to that one as well, and that's from David R. George III. And also we have one more here, which we've talked about a little bit in the past, Matthew. This is Light Fantastic, where it's a follow-up to the Cold Equations trilogy, and Jeffrey Lang is going to follow up David Mack's stories by bringing Data back further, fleshing out what's happening with Data post-Cold Equations.
Yeah, this is going to be interesting, especially since as Data and his daughter try to make their way in a backward, you know, alien world, as they obviously are not a part of Starfleet at this point in time, they're going to run into none other than holographic Master Criminal James Moriarty, which I don't know that that happens on a, backward alien planet that they're living on. It might not be backward, but still, it's going to be an alien planet. So I'm not sure how you get Moriarty, but this is going to be really interesting. And in fact, apparently, you know, long believed that he was in that memory stick that they put him in, and apparently he's created a siphon into the real world, and now he's ready to wreak havoc because basically he wants a body just like Data has now. So this is going to be a quite an interesting story, and I'll be interested to see where Data ends up after this book is over.
It is. Just listening to you describe it, I'm thinking, how does all that work? How does that come together? As you said, how does Moriarty end up on an alien planet? So I think this is one where seriously just, I'm going to have to grab it and read it to find out where it's going, because I like the episodes that Moriarty is in on TNG.
Definitely.
But I remember how it ended and how they solved the problem and what they did with him. So yeah, a little bit difficult to imagine how he comes, you know, back into the real world and how all this is going to play out.
Yeah, it is going to be really interesting. And so this will come out. And then the last thing that we had, Chris, and the reason I didn't put it fully on the docket was just that the first two blurbs for the Seekers books came out, and they're not the finalized versions. And so we'll put the link there in the show notes for you so you can go check that out, the Trek Collective. But that's not the finalized version, so I figured we'd wait and talk about those when they finally got the back of the book, the way they're going to have it on the actual book. And so but that's exciting that that's partly out. You can go check that out, the new series that David Mack and Dayton Ward and Kevin Dillmore are working on that we are very excited about to see. And so, yeah, all of this really rounding out, as I was talking to James on the interview, we were talking about, actually, I think it was on the other side of the book, that this is going to be a really well-rounded year for Trek books. There's a lot coming out from a lot of different parts of the Star Trek universe. So we have a lot to look forward to in 2014.
Most definitely. And of course, books aren't the only thing we have to look forward to. There's been a lot of activity in the comics, especially here just to close out the year. There's been a lot of activity. You know, we had the Byrne photo comic that we talked about last week. We've had more Khan, and we've got more ongoing, which we'll talk about ongoing number 28 here in just a moment. But the year is going to be kicking off with a lot more stuff as well. We've got Star Trek ongoing number 31 here, Enterprise Part 1. It's part one of an epic all-new two-part adventure that is, of course, set within the continuity of the Abramsverse. We're wrapping up now, as we're going to talk about today, the last part of the Kittimer conflict story arc, which takes us beyond Into Darkness. And then 29 and 30 are going to move us further along. And then here, we're going to find Captain Kirk and the crew facing a threat like one they've never faced before. Which, when I read that, I'm thinking, how is that possible? They faced off against Khan and Admiral Marcus, and they've had so many threats. But no, this one is going to be their own ship.
That is interesting. Does the Enterprise like gain sentience and then turns against them or something?
Maybe. Yeah.
Because that happened in a Titan novel.
It could be. It could be. That is a good question, just based on what we know right now. We don't know if it means that there is a duplicate of the crew that they're going to face off against, or if it's just the ship, or if it's not a duplicate, but it's just that the ship itself somehow turns against the crew, which is what I think is probably more likely.
Yeah, this looks really interesting. And so I'm excited. Ongoing has been relatively good throughout the year in the sense that most of the issues have been well done and we have liked. And so I'm excited.
Especially
to see
that Keenzer backstory issue.
Oh my gosh, the Keenzer backstory. Standout of the year. Gosh, goodness. That's what I got to say. Why hasn't there been more Keenzer in this, you know, Kittimer conflict? I'm really disappointed. I feel like he needs to have a larger part in the stories. I feel like he'd be the one, you know, on these covert missions, kicking a lot of ass, especially
right.
Klingon ass, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it's handy to have a little guy like him, because then when the enemies think they have you trapped, he runs in. Like
exactly.
He kind of under. It's like
What was the player's
name for the Charlotte Hornets? They used to have the little.
Oh, Muggsy Bogues. Yeah.
Muggsy, yeah. He was so much shorter than everyone else. I mean, he was a true weapon, and I think Keenzer would be like that as well.
Yeah, we just dated ourselves, Chris, with that Muggsy Bogues reference. Everybody's scratching their heads like,
Exactly.
I don't remember players from the early 90s.
Oh, at least we didn't talk about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Larry Bird.
Huh, no kidding. Or maybe a little Penny Hardaway and... Oh, goodness. Man, anyway.
All right.
Well, so the next thing we got coming out in comics there is going to be this Star Trek Gold Key Archives Volume 1. And they're going to be presenting the first comic book adventures of the USS Enterprise and her crew in this fully remastered and with a brand new throwback cover. This is going to be issues 1 through 6. And so exciting to see them really going back and taking these old comics, remastering and putting them together. I love that. In fact, again, on the other side of the book, James and I were talking about this, and he was talking about how he loves that we do all these old comics, like these DC comics and stuff. And he's like, I even have that CD that you and Chris talk about. And so he's read all of these comics, and he said he actually has every single Star Trek comic.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, you know, yeah. It's great to see IDW really investing in these old comics and bringing them back for fans to be able to enjoy.
I'm feeling a resurgence of the Gold Key comics because we talked about this story on the Ready Room maybe last week that Hot Wheels, they're doing these Star Trek cars coming up in 2014, and the artwork that they're doing on the cars, they're taking from the Gold Key comics.
Mm.
So there's something going on here with a resurgence.
Hmm. Yeah, that's great. Well, I'm glad to see it, and it'll be fun to talk about them. And so it's good to see again IDW just enjoying the background, the plethora of Star Trek comics for them to be able to kind of get the rights to and be able to give back to Star Trek fans.
Most definitely. Well, those are all of the actual news items that we have here to close out the year. But before we get into the interview and the feature, we do have one more thing to talk about. That's ongoing number 28. And this did just come out this week. And Matthew, we've both read it. And I was really happy to be able to end the year with the conclusion of the Kittimer conflict. And once again, I mean, we've talked about how much we like this story. And I have to say that overall, I think it was a good conclusion. What did you think about it?
Yeah, Chris, I have to agree with you. It starts off in a really interesting spot where a Vulcan is talking to Yuki, and I thought that was really a great way to start, because at first I was scratching my head. I was like, oh my goodness, what is this? And then you realize she's talking to her roommate at the academy, and as they're talking, the red matter destroys Vulcan. And so you can understand the reason why she has this desire to join Section 31. She has this deep-seated anger at the people who have attacked the Federation, and this is why she joins them. And you know, it's so interesting because it puts her at odds definitely with Hikaru, who is asked to join Section 31 and turn them down, and kind of seeing what drives people. You know, it's only a couple of page scene, but it's effective enough to make this character really come alive and make her choice here to be a part of Section 131 something that makes more sense.
Yeah, I agree. It's the first two pages of the comic, and I'm glad that they did it, just because I know personally myself as a reader, I needed this justification to know why she decided to be part of Section 31, why she has at least I assume she has animosity towards the Romulans, as well as the Klingons, but especially the Romulans, and why they brought her in the first place. So this was an important start to the story, I think, to help the rest of the story make sense to me and for me to be able to buy into it. So before we go any further, we'll give you a spoiler alert, because we are going to talk about some things that happen here in the comic, although this isn't going to be an in-depth review. So after those scenes happen, we cut back to where we ended with part 3, where we have Yuki Sulu there on Kronos holding the phasers, pointing a phaser at her brother.
Yeah, and the Romulans beam down, and they have the last bit of red matter energy, which they say they're going to use to destroy the capital of Kronos. And they realize, obviously, they're not going to destroy the entire planet like they were able to do, was able to happen with Vulcan. They're going to destroy enough of you know, the planet on Kronos, that it's going to be a big deal.
Which I think is a terrible idea, though. Don't you agree? And this is kind of the thing that Kirk points out to them, that all you're going to do is make the Klingons angrier and make them come after you. I think that what Nero did to Vulcan, I mean, that was significant because he destroyed the entire planet and there were very few Vulcans remaining. Plus, the Vulcans were not an aggressive species like the Klingons to start with. But, you know, mm-hmm. the Klingons have other territories here. You're not going to be killing. You're only going to be killing a small fraction. It would be like here on Earth if you were to destroy New York City. Yeah, you're going to kill a lot of people, but all you're going to do is cause the United States to retaliate against you. And I think that this plan that the Romulans in Section 31 have here is extremely short-sighted.
Well, and what's so interesting is that that gets pointed out by Kirk. Mm-hmm. And then Section 31 shows up and basically does a turnaround. They show up in this, you know, fancy ship of theirs. They come out of nowhere. The Romulans aren't happy about it. Section 31 basically takes over the entire operation because they are able to destroy all of the Romulan ships because they were the ones who supplied the Romulans with the technology to build those ships, and they planted a virus in them so they could destroy them. And they're the ones who end up with the red matter, and they also end up not destroying Kronos. So it's pretty scary that this Section 31 has the red matter in their hands. They have these really advanced starships, and who knows how that's going to turn out later on down the line.
Right. You don't know for sure what's going to happen. Speaking of their ship, isn't this like the Stargazer on steroids in the Abrams verse?
Yes, it is. It does look like the Stargazer on steroids. In fact, I wonder if that was the design idea it was because it
feels
really
like
does,
it may have been. Yeah.
It does look like the Stargazer, which is interesting. And well, I mean, it looks like the Stargazer and the Vengeance put together, because if you look real closely on that big page, it has the kind of open area inside the saucer.
Right. Yeah.
It has this very strange saucer section. So yeah, it's a cool looking thing. I mean, it's a cool looking ship.
When Into Darkness was just coming out, I saw the Vengeance referred to as the ring ship in some places, because of the way the saucer section has that opening in the center. So, well, you know, you say you're not sure how this is going to turn out with the fact that Section 31 has the red matter. But the thing is here, too, and this became very transparent to me. It's very true. What the story is saying here is very true. I think I might have wanted to see a little bit less transparent spin put on it, but they go directly into equating the red matter with nuclear weapons, which it's purely a deterrent. You know, it's pointed out to them that having the red matter in your possession as a deterrent to the Klingons is more powerful than actually using it. And it's pretty much exactly the case. Of course, here on Earth, we did use atomic weapons one time in war, and everyone saw what happened, and everyone said, okay, we can't do that again. That has to be off the table. But if you push us far enough, we will. And so it becomes a deterrent. And that's pretty much exactly what's going on here with the red matter. And so this is really setting up like a Cold War scenario.
Yes.
Between the Romulans and the Klingons and the Federation.
Right. Well, and with the Klingon fleet being really crippled, the Romulan fleet also being crippled, the Federation is in a much stronger position at the moment. And I like that where the comic ends, you know, the Kirk talking about this idea of, you know, with all this uncertainty and in a fear, it's even more important that the Enterprise continue on this original mission that she'd been given before this started, which was the 5-year mission of boldly going where no one has gone before. This really sets up a great opportunity then for the ongoing comics to start doing that. And at the same time, they have a lot of mythology that they've created for their comic to be able to play with when they want to. So I'm very excited to see where this goes in 2014.
The question is, are they really going on the 5-year mission now? Because, you know, they keep stalling. They keep saying we're going to go on the mission. At the end of Into Darkness, they said they're going to go on the mission. They keep saying they're going to go. And here, like you say, on this last page, the Enterprise warps away. Yeah. And they're going to go on the mission. But I don't know. I'm not going to believe them until I actually see them doing a real 5-year mission bit in the comic.
I'm with you. But
because we know in the next one, we're going to get Jane Kirk, right?
That is true. So it'll be interesting to see how they run into her.
Yeah. So we'll see. But overall, this was another, it was a good issue. Artwork was really well done again. Very cool scene of all the Romulan ships exploding as the Enterprise and the Section 31 ship.
Yes, I love that.
Yeah. And the overall series, Kittimer Conflict here, I give it a really high rating. I mean, I give it maybe, you know, like 9 out of 10 unexpectedly deceptive sisters.
Oh my goodness. Wow. Wow. I hadn't even thought of a rating, Chris, but if I were to rate this, I'd probably have to go with, 7.5 out of 10 ass-kicking Zaras.
That's a great rating. Yeah, I like that too. So it's a really good series. If you haven't read it yet, I definitely recommend picking it up. And, you know, you might want to hold off picking up the individual ones just because it is the kind of thing where I would expect sometime, what do you think, Matthew, maybe first quarter, there's no announcement yet, but maybe first quarter of the year, they'll probably do an omnibus of this.
You know, I think, yeah, this should be coming out soon. In fact, I think if I remember looking at, actually, volume 7, Chris, of the ongoing comic is going to be coming out soon. It looks like it's going to be a March solicitation, I think, here, according to Trek Collective. So that is exciting. Yeah, if you can wait, you know, maybe you might want to. But, you know, honestly, I'd say don't wait. Just go pick up the issues. They're fantastic. Use those gift cards you get and pick this up. You won't be sorry.
Yeah. And if you're trying to decide between, let's say, the Star Trek Annual, the John Byrne photo comic that we talked about last week, and Kittimer Conflict, I recommend picking up Kittimer Conflict with those gift cards. Well, that is everything that we have in news and our comic discussion, Matthew. So it's time to jump into the feature with James. But before we do that, let's tell everyone about our sponsor for this week's show, Squarespace. Squarespace is the best hosting in CMS. It makes it really simple for you to create your own blog, website, portfolio, or online store. And there are several things that I love about Squarespace. And one of them, of course, is that it's very design focused because I am a designer and I really care about aesthetics. And but at the same time, you know, if I have information I want to get out there, I want to just get it on the web. I don't want to put all my time into the design process and the coding because I need to be writing the content. Or like here at Trek FM is built on Squarespace, by the way. We need to produce the podcasts. We have to record. We have to edit. We want to push that stuff out to all of you guys. So we don't want to spend our time coding the website. So Squarespace's design focus makes that really, really easy. And also, there are the connected accounts, Matthew, where you can push your content out there to Twitter, to Facebook, to places like that. What's your favorite social media channel, Matthew, for if you're like me, you don't really go out looking for content on the web as much as you just wait for people to push it to you?
You know, I really like Twitter for that, Chris, and that's what I use for my own blog as well. I find Twitter works really well. But at the same time, you know, I think the main ones for me are Twitter and Facebook, and they really seem to be the best ones, for kind of getting people to my site. I love the ease of use of Squarespace and being able to push to those very easily. And I think that's great, because those are great. Like you said, so many times I find a news article because I'm looking at the Twitter feed, not just because I'm going and perusing websites.
Exactly. And of course, responsive design is really important because I read things on my desktop, and you know, I have large displays on the desktop, but I also read on my iPad, I read on my iPhone. The screen sizes are very, very different. And I know that as a designer, it's really tedious to create multiple versions of a website so that it looks great on both platforms. And with Squarespace, you don't have to do that. You just do the site one time and it's going to reflow and it's going to look fantastic no matter what the screen size or orientation is.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the nice things about Squarespace is that it's so easy to do. You don't have to be tech savvy. If you're like me, you're not. And this really gives you the ability to take that, put it out there, and not have to worry about that kind of stuff. And I love that because I don't want to have to spend all my time trying to figure out how to make the website. I just want to be able to put my content out there.
Exactly. And also, if you want to sell products, if you're a crafter, even if you're a big business, if you want to sell physical or digital products online, it can be sort of difficult to get that set up. You know, you have to go and set up a store infrastructure. You have to be able to process credit cards. And if you're a business, for example, and you have to have corporate PayPal, that there are a lot of hoops to jump through to set that up because I've done it before for my own business. But with Squarespace, they've integrated Stripe into the platform. And so as a Squarespace customer, you get 30-second merchant sign up. You get instant approval, no paperwork to do. And in a matter of minutes, you can begin receiving money for purchases via direct deposit. Full tax and shipping rules by region are handled by Stripe, by the platform. And this is available in the US, UK, Canada, Australia, Belgium, France, Germany, Ireland, the Netherlands, and Spain right now. And that list of countries is going to be expanding in the future. So it's a really, really easy way for you to accept credit cards online, to sell your products. You can even print your shipping labels, packing slips through the interface there. You can send customer update emails. You can track outstanding orders. You can even move your existing Shopify or Big Cartel inventory over to Squarespace with just a few clicks. So blog, online store, site for your personal writing, your fiction, you can do it all with Squarespace. And the best way to find out how easy it is to try it free for 14 days. There's no credit card required. Just go enter your name and your email address. And in a matter of minutes, you will be creating a beautiful website using the exceptional tools at Squarespace. Plans start at just $8 per month. You can get unlimited everything for $16. And if you want the commerce feature, that's just $24 per month. And as a Trek FM listener, you can save 10% off your purchase by using offer code TREK12. And doing so helps us bring Literary Treks to you every week. So it's a great way for you to get a great website and help us at the same time. So just go to squarespace.com to try it for free. Remember to choose the annual plan and you'll get a custom domain registration for free as well. And we really thank Squarespace for their support of Literary Treks and the network.
We've got James Swallow with us tonight to be talking about his newest novel, The Poison Chalice, which is the fourth of five novels making up the fall miniseries. And as we all know, centers around the Federation, the Typhon Pact, and the shenanigans that have been going on with them for quite a while now. And this series really wrapping up a big segment of the 24th century for us. And this book focuses really on the characters from the Titan, although there are other characters from other series in the mix, as there have been in all the books. And so, James, first, welcome to back to the show.
It's a pleasure to be back. Thank you very much for having me on again and giving me an opportunity to just talk about Star Trek.
Oh, of course. I love getting to talk to the authors. It's so much fun. I have got to say, and I don't want to disparage anything else anybody else has done throughout the year in Star Trek Lit, but I have to say I think that the fall was what I was looking for the most all year, and there has not been a disappointment in the mix. You guys, I feel like, pulled out all the stops and have made an incredible series, and I can't wait now till Dayton wraps it up in a couple weeks for us, so I'm on the edge of my seat.
Yeah, totally. I think we done pretty good, didn't we? I mean, I think we all really raised our game. We came into this and I think brought our A game.
Oh, definitely. I think this is the A+ game. So, which was fantastic for all the readers. And I think just, in general, you know, we had all of the TOS novels at the beginning of the year and just really chomping at the bit for that 24th century, because it had been gone for so long. You know, we were waiting so long, and it's great to have it back. And then the way that you guys, like you said, just raised your game and really brought it. It really shows in this series, so I'm glad to see that.
Thanks a lot. I mean, and I can certainly say, you know, having read Peaceable Kingdoms quite a while ago, Dayton brings the thunder at the end. Believe me, it's pretty cool.
Oh, man, I can't wait. Well, okay, so you've got the fourth book in the series, and tell me just about, you know, the genesis for you of your story with the Titan. I mean, you've written for the Titan before, and you even got to use some of your story pieces. But, you know, tell me about, you know, what that's like to try and write the fourth book in a series so it's not all your idea, and how all that went down for you.
Well, I've done series stuff before, you know, mostly when I've been writing for audio dramas. I did it with the Doctor Who series this year. We had a thing for the 50th anniversary. We did like 12 different CD releases. Each one of us took a different Doctor, and I did one for that. We had an ongoing storyline there. Not quite as intensive a story as we had with The Fall. And I've done it with the Stargate audio series, and also... Okay. With the Horus Heresy novels, which is an ongoing Warhammer 40,000 thing. But this is probably the most tightly plotted thing I've ever worked on as a team player. And it was challenging, you know, in good and bad ways. You know, because you looked at the documentation. I know that when you interviewed Dave Mack, he talked about the spreadsheet, you know, which was all his creation, which was that was our touchstone all through the entire project. You know, you look at that and thinking, man, I've got to fit my storyline in here, and you've got this many days, and you know, all the kind of questions of logistics about simple things about like how long does it take to travel from there to here, can I do that, you know, things like just asking yourself the question, is this character in the same room as these guys, is he on the other side of the galaxy, how do I have a conversation between these two people because I need that to happen dramatically. All those things were a very interesting challenge. But I think we all kind of relished it, and you know, we all got our hands on it and just said, okay, you know, we're going to take this plot line, pull it to pieces, and do something really, really cool. And that was how we started. You know, we had the initial concept. I mean, obviously, spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't read it, but I'm sure we're going to talk in great depth about all these sort of things. Margaret Clark came to us and said, okay, sorry, not Margaret. And she came to us and she said, you know, this is what we're going to do. We're going to have this assassination. We're going to have this kind of shot heard around the galaxy moment in the novels. And then that's where we're going to pick up and carry on. And it was, you know, it was very dramatic. And it's like, well, how do we take this and spread it out over five books and not make it feel like, you know, we're padding it? And how do we kind of create enough pitch and moment and momentum? And it turned out that we had more than we needed to divide this story up into all these different elements. And so, when it came to my turn, it was kind of a bit of it was scheduling, and a bit of it was just kind of personal choice. But Titan was offered to me, and I had such a lot of fun writing the Titan crew for Synthesis. I was looking for an opportunity to go back and tell another story with them. And so it was interesting to do this because it's very much a lot of people were saying to me, is this going to be a traditional Titan novel? You know, is it about the kind of right. strange new worlds, the exploratory nature of Titan? And it really isn't. But it's a Fall novel before it's a Titan novel, because, you know, the Titan series to me has always been kind of like a classic Trek sensibility in a TNG era world. Whereas this is much more, this is a political thriller. That is what this novel is about. And, you know, you'll see the Titan characters that you like behaving in a different way and being exposed to a different style of problem. And I thought that was interesting because, you know, we're going to get more Titan novels in the future, and those Titan novels will be your traditional Titan novel. Here's a chance to kind of take them out of their comfort zone. And, you know, that's the whole kind of theme behind it. In fact, if anything, that could be the alternative title for this novel, you know, out of your comfort zone, because pretty much everybody in this story is dragged into a situation they don't want to be in. And that's kind of where the title, The Poison Chalice, originally came from, is the idea that, you know, Riker is given this promotion, which on paper sounds like a really great idea, but it's a poison chalice. You know, it turns out that it's not what he thought it was. And in fact, you know, he's being dragged into something that he doesn't want to be involved in, and it all starts to go horribly wrong. And he's trying to kind of, you know, run ahead of the avalanche to try and sort out this situation and not get crushed underneath the weight of it. And so putting all of that together with these characters, and, you know, Riker's always been one of my favorite characters. So it was a joy to get a chance to write him some more. And, and picking up the threads that had been laid down by the other guys and trying to do something interesting with that. That was an interesting challenge as well. And of course, because I'm 4 or 5, I had to make sure that I could tell enough story to make my book interesting, but not too much, because I have to leave some cool stuff for Dayton to do. And right. So he comes in and he picks up the threads that I leave hanging, and he has his own cool stuff. And, you know, he has the job of kind of bringing it all to a kind of crashing conclusion, which he does ably, I have to say. And that was fun for me I guess I'm kind of like raising the curtain on the finale at the end of this novel. And so if anything, he and I were the ones who I think we worked the closest together to try and synchronize everything that we were doing. So it's, I think, was it Una McCormack said that it's like a relay race? Is it pretty much was narratively passing the baton from one writer to another? And it really, really is that. And it's interesting because we all have very, very different styles from each other. You know, Una's style is not like mine. Neither is Dayton's or David Mack or David R. George. You know, we all take a completely different approach to the way we write stories. But in a way, I think that's really made the fall stronger, because, you know, the differences in the way that we write and the differences in the approaches we have behind our writing have combined to create a really interesting sort of cocktail. And underneath it all, we've got this strong, compelling storyline, which is just now racing towards a conclusion.
Well, I have to say that, you know, your connection with David's book before you, I think, worked out smoothly and really well done, because I didn't feel any kind of jarring or a real noticeable difference in the sense that the way that David was able to finish his story, David Mack, that is, was finished his story, and then you moved into yours, it felt very seamless, because, you know, he ends with Titan being recalled, and you pick right up where he left off, and it was perfect. You know, I felt like there was an ending to his story, but then I knew something else was coming, and I really do feel that, you know, there's a conclusion to what happened in your book, but I know Dayton is just going to take that and pick that right back up. And so it's been so well done. And for me, as being somebody who's read a lot of tie-in fiction through a lot of different universes, the way that this multi-book, multi-authored series has been done has almost been flawless, which is really very rare to be able to say. So just a kudos to you guys for really, you know, stepping up. And I think, you know, you're talking about David making the big, huge flow chart for you guys. It paid off beautifully, because I don't feel like there's any kind of jarring, even though you guys do have different styles in the way you write. And it's made these wonderful collection of books that each has their own individual style to them. The storyline itself feels very fluid, and that's fantastic.
I mean, it's, you know, sometimes with a mini series like this, you'll have somebody who kind of takes almost a supervisory role and, you know, will just sort of lead the concept through. We didn't have that. I think we all clicked really well, because I think we all understand each other's work. We all respect each other's work. And we all just understood this is the needs of this particular narrative. And we all know what our strengths are. So we were all like, okay, well, let's all play to our strengths. Let's do all of us do what we do well. And we were lucky enough that we kind of created a 5-book arena for us, you know, to kind of play to our strengths. And because we talked a lot, I mean, certainly in the initial phases, we were just sending back, you know, reams and reams of emails about how are we going to do this? Who is this character? What does this guy look like? What's his name? How does he dress? You know, and we were passing backwards and forwards lots of different character notes. And so I think in a very real way, every other writer, to a lesser or greater degree, has a hand in every other book. And that definitely pays off, because we all feel like we had a stake in it. You know, we're trying to kind of, honestly, let's be honest, we're writers, we're trying to one up each other. So we want to do something cool that you're going to go, wow, you know, you like this book and I'm going to do this cool thing. But at the same time as well, I think we were all really invested in seeing everybody else's books be as good as they possibly could be. And I think it really paid off at the end. And I was just pleased to, you know, and like I said, I was just pleased to get my hands back on the Titan crew again, you know, because I enjoyed writing them. And I always like taking characters from their sort of normal positions and the kind of things that, you know, you expect to see them doing, and putting them in a situation where, you know, the unexpected is happening, and then just say, okay, now get out of that. And that was, that was the way that that Poison Chalice came together, and it was an opportunity for me to do that with Rhino, to kind of meld that with a kind of action thriller espionage kind of story that, you know, in the end, it just seemed to hit all the right marks. And I think it comes at the right place as well, because, you know, I'm raising the curtain before the end of the story. So I felt like this needed to be a story that was fast moving, that had a lot of, you know, action and a lot of pace to it, because the last thing you want is it to kind of slow down before we reach that kind of final conclusion.
Well, that's tough. I mean, you know, when you're writing the penultimate book in a series, often that kind of feels like that happens, because really what people are wanting is the end. But I reading through the series, it does feel like I get enough of the answers and a little bit of the conclusion, so I know what the end game is, but I feel satisfied enough where you left us. And that is definitely a hard thing to do. So I'm glad that you got a chance to get back to Titan. I enjoyed Synthesis a lot. And I think having Riker in this position really works with that kind of action, adventure, political intrigue. It strangely works well. I mean, Riker is a character, I think, that I think Akkar picked a perfect person to bring back. You know, he even says in the book, this is why it's not Picard or Sisko or somebody else, it's you. I think Riker has just enough of that Kirk in him to make this really work.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I feel that's totally where he's coming from, is because, you know, when Akkar won't even level with him, and he's basically going, okay, well, look, you know, you're not going to tell me what the problem is. Fine, I'll go and find out myself. And when he finally has that conversation where he levels with him, he's like, well, I've already started work on this, actually. You know, I got sick of waiting for you to tell me what was going on, so I've already found out some of the answers myself, because that's who I am. You know, Riker's the full Riker. You know, when you see him walk across the bridge and he puts his shoulder forward and off he goes, that's Will Riker, you know?
puts his leg up on something.
Yeah, you know, and that's what he's doing. And I see him, I've always seen Riker having that attitude towards life. He's like, here is a problem. Well, you know what? I'm gonna take this head on, and I'm gonna try and solve it. And I'm gonna, you know, if I have to kind of bull my way through it, I'll do that. But if I can find a way to think my way through that, you know, and use his instincts to get through a situation, that's exactly what he's going to do. And I've always felt that that's Riker's strength. He does have a little of the Kirkian sort of flavor to him as well, but at the same time, he's a well-rounded character in a different way from Kirk, because of, especially in the later novels now, the way he's developing into a father and a husband, and he has different priorities. And suddenly, in amongst all of that, he's like promoted to Admiral, which is traditionally kind of almost in the Star Trek universe, like that's the death of your career, because after you become an Admiral, all you get to do is kind of mess around with captains and occasionally go crazy or get possessed by aliens or something, you know. From, I even made it to that where, you know, he's talking to one of the crew members and he says, like, look, every time you get promoted to an Admiral, it doesn't automatically mean that you lose your marbles. And the guy's like, well, you know, the day is young, sir. We'll have to see how that plays out.
Yeah, I loved that because, you know, we have rarely seen somebody be an Admiral. I think except for Admiral Ross in DS9, he's the only one that you respected, really, when he came on screen. And mainly because he had that relationship with Sisko and Sisko respected him. Mm-hmm. And he's very, there's very, very few admirals. And of course, when Kirk was an admiral, we all loved him. So, it's interesting because I think Riker and, Sisko and maybe even a little bit Janeway, they're the captains we know from the 24th century that I think could probably make it in the 23rd century where you have all that autonomy. You can really think for yourself and you trust their decisions to make. And so I really appreciate, you know, Riker being thrown in this position and having to put to use all that he's learned from Picard and everything else in his career to make the right decisions here. It reminded me a lot. This book reminded me a lot of In the Pale Moonlight with the discussions that Sisko has to have and what he has to do to get there. And I feel like Riker really has to go down that road, and he has that moment himself in this book of doing things he doesn't necessarily believe are right, but he's doing them for the right reasons. And that's such an interesting discussion to be having throughout this whole entire book.
I mean, there was actually something I wanted to put in there, and in the end I didn't find a convenient place to illustrate, is I wanted to have him think about Eric Pressman. you know, as a guy who was a commanding officer of his who became an admiral. And in the end, I couldn't fight. It just kind of felt like I was repeating the same kind of stuff I'd already said. And I thought, I don't want to draw attention away from Will. But that was very much in my mind, is the idea of, I knew he would be thinking about that guy, that he would be thinking about Pressman and Leighton and you know, every other admiral on Star Trek who's kind of let the power go to their head a little bit. And he's asking himself this question, you know, maybe that's the way that those guys started off, is in the situation I'm in right now. It's you know, okay, I have a thing to do here and I've got more power and, you know, I can see the right choice. And so I'm going to do this stuff. But is that the road to ruin? You know, and he, in the back of his head, he's thinking about all of that while he's trying to deal with this situation that's kind of crashing down around him at the same time.
Well, and then because of that, I mean, so throughout the series, I feel like reading it, I've kind of walked through the 20th century and our wars and our Cold Wars and, you know, our most recent wars. And so we finally got into your book, and every book has had a bit of real world influence. What were some of yours for this book? Because there are quite a lot, especially for today's world.
Well, you know, I mean, definitely the Cold War is a very strong influence on this. I mean, I'm, you know, I'm a child of the 1980s. I grew up with the, you know, the threat of nuclear Armageddon hanging over my head. And it's something I've been thinking about very recently, actually, because here in the UK, the BBC have just had a Cold War season on one of their channels, broadcasting documentaries about that era. And watching a lot of that stuff again kind of really reminded me of influences on this book that I wasn't even aware of actually putting in there, about the, you know, the nature of the sort of the politics and the this sort of like slow burn of espionage that's going on, and people making decisions that are morally questionable that are being swept under the carpet, while, you know, the whole bread and circuses thing is going on, and people's attention are being drawn away from one thing while something really bad is happening. And sadly, it's a truth that that kind of stuff still happens today. And there definitely is connective matter to, you know, more current political events. You know, the story deals with, you know, black sites and rendition and the idea of unsanctioned executive actions. And those are all things that we've seen in contemporary politics. Unfortunately, they're also things that you can trace back to the past as well. You know, it's not just a kind of, you know, year 2000s or 2010s kind of thing. You know, this has been happening for ages. And it was interesting to me, actually. I saw a comment online where somebody was mentioning that and saying how, you know, they felt like some of the stuff I was saying was very much like a thinly veiled allegory of real world events. And they were talking about American politics. And I thought, well, that's interesting because I'm not an American. And a lot of British politics is kind of percolating up through that as well, because we've had our own issues about, you know, the legality of going to war and rendition happening in this country. In fact, where I live is quite close to a small commercial airstrip. And I can remember when the whole rendition thing blew up, is it turned out that they were using that airstrip to render guys, you know, aircraft were stopping there, flying over my house, carrying illegally rendered prisoners, you know. And I'm seeing that in my local newspaper, not even like the big major news sources, but in the little freebie newspaper I get through my letterbox every week. And I'm thinking, this is really kind of coming home to roost. And that really stuck with me, the idea of these things going on, of you know, the secret decisions being made in the corridors of power. And that's not something that we see in Star Trek. And it intrigued me to be able to write a story where we could bring that to light, because the thing about the Star Trek universe is that everybody, they certainly say that they're trying to, that, you know, they're trying to aspire for the very, very best in terms of their society and their culture and their politics. And while they reach for that every time, there is always the possibility that you'll fall short. And the drama, the dynamics of it comes in the kind of the gap between what you aim for and where you actually land. And I like the idea of that. And I think this is the Star Trek universe that we have in the books right now, you know, coming back from the Borg invasion and from all of the situations that have spun out of that. This is a Federation kind of like trying to get back on the upswing now, you know, dealing with the Typhon Pact and all these other threats to its existence. You know, it's a Federation that's completely unlike the ones that we've seen in the TV shows. And I think the books really reflect that, is that it's a Federation where people feel embattled. You know, there's an entire generation of people coming up in Starfleet, and they're people who've lived through the war with the Borg, and, you know, and young people who are now kind of like joining Starfleet, and they have different ideas about the way that Starfleet should be, and maybe they're coming at it from a more militant, more aggressive standpoint, which is not what Starfleet's about, or is it what Starfleet's about now? You know, and it's the dynamic tension between these two sort of like worldviews. Is, you know, if you end up being too quick to reach for your sword, eventually that's the first thing you do in every situation, and that's not Star Trek,
right?
But it's reflecting what feels to me a realistic evolution of that culture and society. And the, you know, and the trying to find its way back to what their true ideals are. This is very definitely a story about that. This is our characters and in a larger sense the Federation being confronted with two paths. You know, do you want to hawk or dove? Which way do you want to go? Even had a Riker say it, where he talks about, you know, there's the possibility of kind of backsliding towards the sort of Cold War era of like Kirk's era, you know, the 23rd century of the Cold War with the Klingons. And, you know, we don't want to go back there, you know, but there's a possibility that that's where we may slide back to, because, you know, once you've been knocked down a few times, you start to think that everybody you see is somebody who's going to knock you down again. And that's to me is an interesting situation. How do you get past that? How, as a culture, does the Federation pick itself up and say, okay, you know, we will not forget what we are and what we want to be?
I think that's something that, you know, reading through this book, I feel like it is such a progression from where DS9 ended. And it's just this whole series that, you know, TNG did a great job of laying out, you know, the ideals of the Federation and what the 24th century wanted to be. And then Deep Space Nine took those lofty ideals and said, okay, now you need to live in a universe that doesn't really share those ideals. And how does that play out, especially when it comes to the ideas of war and all these other things that we hadn't seen before? And the book series have done a great job, I think, of just taking that and pushing it forward, you know, as things like the Borg have happened now and the Typhon Pack and all of that, putting it together, what happens to a society, as you said, you know, you've had 10, 20 years of people being raised in a completely different climate than, say, when, you know, Picard first stepped on the Enterprise D and they were boldly going. It's a whole new world, and it looks very different. And, you know, Riker talking about this idea of trying to get back to hope, is, I think, the key to this whole series is, okay, there are these divergent paths, like you said, you can go down this evil type of political road that's going to lead you into just chaos, or you can take the road that we all really want to be on, is, you know, we're going to do the right thing for the right reasons, no matter how hard it is. And, you know, there's those two divergent paths. I really love this series is really dealing with that, because, you know, honestly, as you said, the world is dealing with these issues too. And reading this series has really helped me kind of think through a lot of those different things from the last, you know, 15 years of what's been going on in our own world. And that's really what I think Star Trek does best, and the fact that the writers have been able to pull that out for us all that are reading the series. It's exactly what Gene, I think, wanted, even if, you know, he might not love that the 24th century is in this predicament now. It's helping me, and it's helping other readers, I think about our world and where do we want to go?
Well, that's definitely, I mean, you know, certainly Star Trek's always been good at doing that thing that that science fiction is very good with, which is holding up a funhouse mirror to the real world, you know, because you can't talk about racism. So you have a story about the planet of the half black, half white people, you know, and you can't talk about the Vietnam War. So you have, you know, you have Yangs and Combs and stuff like that, you know, and it sounds a little crude to us now, but that is one of the strengths of science fiction, is it can ask you questions that are difficult because you can take it one step removed. You go, okay, we're not, we know we're talking about people in the future, or we're talking about people on different planets. So you can step back from that and ask yourself, well, you know, this isn't my world, so I can look at it in a more dispassionate sort of way. So I think Star Trek works with that very well. It's certainly, you know, we are looking at a generation in the current era of the novels. It's a post-war generation, if you think of it in that sense. You know, and I look at my family, you know, who are coming out after the Second World War. It's like, you know, what was life like for people growing up in that post-war generation? It's a very different experience in Europe than it was for the experience of Americans growing up.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You know, when you've got the austerity and you've got the kind of, you know, you've got the rubble of war still kind of all around you. You know, people still living in the ashes of the Second World War and trying to rebuild their lives, dealing with all of that. And it's very hard for you to sort of say, well, you know, I want to reach for hope, because you're just trying to kind of make sure that, you know, your house is going to stay up. You know, nobody's now, but they were shooting at you yesterday and they might be shooting at you tomorrow. So, you know, how are you going to deal with that? And I think that sort of mindset, the idea of a post-war Star Trek generation, that's all bubbling away in the background. You know, we don't really see that in our lead characters in the story, but I wanted to kind of set that up as almost as if that's the audience, that's the world that's passing by in the background while our heroes are having their adventures, is that there's this is the transition that's happening, and so we are at that point of the junction between these two paths, is that we can go down a sort of darker route where people's hearts will harden a little more because of the experiences they've gone through, or will they remember to, you know, to still keep the things that are true and strong and good and try and hope for the very, very best. And that's illustrated with the political situation where, you know, it literally is the hawks versus the doves. And, you know, and do you have to become a little bit of, in order to beat them? And again, it's going back to a very Deep Space Nine thing, you know, the issue that Sisko deals with. You know, with Garak helping him to bring the Romulans into the Dominion War.
Definitely.
You know, that goes to a very dark place for Star Trek, but it feels very real and it feels very true. And I think that there's definitely a situation like that going on in the fall where, you know, there's this, this evolution from an assassination to discovery of what appears to be a murder plot, but then there's like layer upon layer of what's actually going on and who's responsible and, you know, who caused this to happen, who aided and abetted. How do you apportion responsibility for this crime? Is it the guy who pulled the trigger, or is it the guy who paid the guy who pulled the trigger? And, you know, we start to unpack the truth behind the Bacow assassination, and it just becomes more and more ugly the deeper you go. And I think Riker certainly has that moment where it's like he's feeling, I don't know if I want to look any deeper. How much of this is going to change me? And then, you know, he's looking over his shoulder at his family and his friends and saying, well, I have to do it for those people. And so maybe, you know, truth needs a soldier in this story. And that's pretty much, you know, Riker and to a lesser extent, Nog and Vale and Tuvok all kind of fulfill that sort of role.
Well, and you know, Riker talks about that whole idea of pushing agendas based on fear instead of hope. And it really rings so true. And what I really enjoyed that Riker does, though, is he lays out where that hope is based. And it's based in the principles and the ideals of the Federation that have been there since the beginning. So it's not just some kind of nebulous idea of hope, but he has a real concrete idea of what they're working towards. And, you know, that's really the only way to combat fear is with another principle, one that's even better and more worthy to aspire to. And I love that you called him Truth Soldier. What a great name for Riker. We should work that into a future book or something.
I think it's definitely, you know, that is the whole idea of the grand ideal of the Federation, of it being a place where everybody is welcome, where, you know, that everyone can have a voice, and that, you know, we can move forward in unity and achieve great things. You know, that's what the Federation is. That's what the word means. And being challenged in this way to turn it into something darker, something that's more defensive, that's something like it cuts right to the very of certainly, you know, Riker and his oath, and you know, and the other Starfleet characters, you know, their oath is to sort of, you know, as well as doing the whole kind of like, you know, boldly going and strange new world stuff, it's also to kind of keep home and hearth safe, and they have to, you know, consider both of these things. And it's difficult to think about, you know, well, let's go off and explore some distant part of the galaxy when, well, you know, is there a possibility that while I'm away, my home is going to be attacked? And, you know, should I stay closer to home? And then you start getting into defensive thinking and siege mentality. And before you know it, you know, you become inward looking. And that's what the Federation, you know, the principles of the Federation are very much about, you know, the whole idea of this, you know, we're not just seeking answers to the questions that we have, but we're also seeking new questions. And we can't lose that desire to see what's over the next hill, you know, that sense of wonder. And I think those ideals all speak to that. And that's Riker totally, you know, articulating that in that moment, saying, you know, this is who we are. Do not forget, this is who we are. This is where we came from. These were good ideas when they were first invented. They're still good ideas now, you know, and even if things have changed, there's still stuff that we can pull from this, you know, that we can use that will make us better people. And, you know, I think he's a great character to articulate that sort of thing, because I think Riker completely and wholly believes in the good of the Federation. He's not, you know, he's although he's lived through dark times, I think he's still deep down inside, you know, he's 100% behind it, stands four square on that thing, and he doesn't want to let it go. He doesn't want to see it die off and become something darker.
One of the things that Carew says in the book, he says politics will always be a source of argument. You know, in today's world, obviously, it's so true. I don't know if you have in England there, but we do here on Netflix, a show called House of Cards that they did. And it's this political maneuvering show. And it's just layer upon layer in each episode of all these people. And it feels like, you know, tri-dimensional chess on crack, but with politics. And that's what I really feel like this series is doing with the politics. It's just showing the layer upon layer of deception and control that somebody can exert through the political system if not held to the law, and how we can kind of bend and twist and, you know, contort things and, you know, turn what was good into evil and all that happening. You know, it drives you crazy. Because it's happening today, and it seems to be not a ton that we can do about it.
You know, it's funny you talk about House of Cards, because you may not be aware that that was actually a British television series from the 1980s.
I was not. That's my negligence in not looking that up.
It was originally based on a novel written by a guy who was actually in Margaret Thatcher's cabinet, and a lot of the story was based on true facts. I think there were three books, and they made them into three TV miniseries here in the UK.
Okay.
And it's basically about a guy who, you know, it's the same thing about, you know, he talks to camera and he does the whole breaking the fourth wall sort of thing. And it's this guy who basically manipulates his way into becoming the prime minister through various unpleasant shenanigans. And yeah, that was something that I saw when I was younger, and that was definitely an influence on me. I think, you know, I know Una McCormack's a big fan of that series as well. And it was interesting to see, you know, David Fincher and the guys from Netflix and Kevin Spacey taking that on and kind of reinventing that concept and transplanting it to America. Because, you know, it's like I just said earlier on, you know, these political ideas, these things aren't old. You know, this was happening in the 80s here in the UK. You know, you could say it's happening now in America, and you could look back into the past and pick other cultures and say, well, you know, was this happening, you know, before the Second World War in Germany, or is it happening in other countries like, you know, like in Japan or Korea or different parts of Europe? You can draw lines back from, sadly, you can draw back lines and showing that this kind of political behavior happens a lot.
Well, and it is interesting because you know, and I think that this idea that politics is always a source of argument is because politics is also the source of power in any system. And now that we've become quote unquote civilized, you know, that's where the power is. And that's what man longs for in the end, in so many ways, is to have some sort of power and control over their domain. And the way that we do that with other humans is through political systems. And so there's always going to be those who want to take it and control it and contort it. And what, you know, I think is so interesting about this series too, none of these contortions of the Federation are happening through Section 31, the kind of thing that we all, you know, look at in the Star Trek universe and we know they're quote unquote bad. This is all just happening within the framework of the Federation itself.
They're always kind of like the boogeyman, the way they've been created in this sort of situation. I mean, I certainly think when Carew says about politics being, you know, the one thing that you can't have a civil conversation about. He is totally channeling me in that moment, because I really feel that's true. You know, what is it they say, the things that you should never talk about at dinner parties, you shouldn't talk about religion or sex or politics.
Which we always end up talking about somehow at dinner parties.
And I look at the Star Trek universe and I think, well, you know what, I think sex and politics, you can probably get that. That would probably be okay if you were in the 24th century having a conversation like about those things around the dining table. You could probably be okay, but politics, power politics, are still going to be a problem in the future. And I think that's definitely him illustrating that right now, because Keru strikes me as he's very much a kind of like salt of the earth, meat and potatoes kind of guy. Doesn't really have time for all of that kind of filibustering. You know, he wants to kind of understand what the situation is. He doesn't want someone to kind of tell him and give him spin. So I think, you know, he's definitely, he's the kind of voice of that sort of person in this situation going, I don't want to deal with all of that. I just want to know what the hell is going on and why is this happening. I want to be able to make an, you know, I want to make an informed choice about the people who are in charge of me and the people that I may one day be in charge of. I want to understand how the system works. I don't want it to be obfuscated under layers of you know, spin. And I think that's definitely one voice, one sort of emotion that's going through these characters while all this circumstance is happening.
James, one of the things that I really enjoyed in the book too is the end where Tuvok and Nog have the conversation about, you know, why they were chosen for the mission. And can you expound on that just a little bit more? Because I thought that was just a really interesting part. And at the same time, I also was like, wow, really glad that those two were there, because without them, if they hadn't been chosen, it would have ended completely differently, that mission.
I mean, on the one hand, obviously they're there because it's dramatically interesting and cool. And
right.
You know, it wouldn't have been a very interesting story if that ship had been full of characters that we didn't know. I mean, when I was putting the storyline together, is I thought, well, you know, I want to have this kind of two-tier story, and it eventually evolved into kind of something larger than that. But my initial concept of it is I thought Riker kind of, Riker's doing the West Wing stuff, you know, he's walking up and down the corridors of power and he's trying to deal with the situation, but he's essentially tied to his desk and he can't get out of Starfleet Command, so he's trying to do the best he can from there. And so I needed another character who could go off and be doing stuff, you know, they're kicking down doors and blowing things up. And I thought, well, you know, who have we got on Titan who's got an interesting background, and then we've got this whole sort of organization, this clandestine group going out and doing stuff. Tuvok immediately springs to mind because he's a guy who's, you know, who's done sort of special ops, black ops work, and he has a kind of espionage background, but he's not like a Section 31 guy. And because he's Tuvok, you know, he is the consummate straight arrow, which makes him a very interesting guy to put into the situation where he's doing very not straight arrow stuff, where he's being called upon to do that. And I always thought that was an interesting thing about Tuvok being a guy who was basically, when we first met him, an undercover agent. How do you square that with being a Vulcan? With, you know, with the idea of trying to adhere to truthfulness in as much as you possibly can and logic. And so that was an interesting place to put him. And then I thought, you know, I want to bring in another character, and I want to bring in somebody who has a different tonality to them, someone who would bark off of Tuvok. And I thought I needed someone who's kind of got a lighter touch on things, but still had a sort of a kind of layer of darkness to him. And that was Nog. And I'd never written his character before, and I kind of liked him on DS9, and I wanted the excuse to just basically steal a DS9 character and put him in there. So Nog definitely has the military background that we've seen in DS9, and he has kind of suffered for it. But he also has a kind of, you know, he's got a lighter personality trait, which makes him fun to sort of, like, you know, just put him side by side with Tuvok, and they have a kind of cool double act going on. But he also has an understanding of the realities of warfare, because he's been at the sharp end.
Yeah, he's got that, and oh God, I hope I don't get in trouble with fans for saying this. He's got that lighter touch of Neelix with the darker side as well. And so he's a much more rounded character in that. He works really well, I think, because he does kind of have this vengeful side that he talks about with Tuvok there at the end. But at the same time, he is kind of that thoughtful, fun-loving Ferengi who enjoys just figuring out technical problems the same way Miles does. And he's got that, fun side we saw with all the times when he'd hang out with Jake and that kind of stuff. So it does make for a great dynamic. I like them working together, and I hopefully to see them work together again sometime, because it was fun. I think they actually learned a lot from each other and made for a good pairing. And like you said, something you had never seen before. And it's always kind of neat when random Star Trek characters get to get together for a good story point and not just, hey, let's throw this character and this character together just because it would be fun. I think it really helped the story.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's actually two first meetings by screen characters in this book, because I was writing that scene, and as I was getting into it, I suddenly thought, oh wait, has anybody actually ever written a scene where Tuvok and Nog are in the same room together and had a conversation? And so I had to go back and delve through all the back history of Trek books looking to see if someone had ever done that story, and I couldn't find it. So I thought, okay, well, I guess now probably someone's going to email me and go, oh, they did it in this comic book or something, and I'll feel like a fool. But I went on the assumption, okay, this is the first time these two guys meet, these two guys from two different TV shows that have never crossed paths before, that are very, very different people from very, very different species, but they share that, that they've both been soldiers, and they've both been wounded by what it is that they did. But because they're very different people, it expresses themselves in very different ways. And at the heart, they also, the other thing they share is they both believe in their Starfleet oath. They're both are good soldiers. And again, they're placed like Riker is in a untenable situation, where eventually they, this is enough. Enough is enough. We can't keep doing this. We're being called upon to do things that none of us are comfortable with. And that's it. I'm not going this far and no further. And I think that's an interesting place to put them in. The other first meeting is Deanna Troi and Julian Bashir.
Oh, that was great.
Because again, I was looking at that and thinking, have these two guys actually met? And I thought, oh, they haven't. And those are two very empathetic characters. And I thought, that's fun to put those guys in a room together and just have them have a conversation and see how that sparks off.
Well, and it was so interesting because, Julian being genetically enhanced, he's able to control his emotions much more than normal humans. And Deanna being the Beta Zed, putting those two together and her not being able to read him as well as she could normal people. I thought that was just an interesting thing, especially with what's going on in Julian's life at this moment. And he's shutting himself down and hiding himself because of the threats he's had, against the people that he loves. I thought that was really, really well done. And I just have to say, God, do I love Vale and do I love the Andorians in this book? Like, I need more Andorians in Star Trek stories, and not just for fight scenes. And Vale was just fantastic. I wanted to reach through the page and kiss that woman for how awesome she was.
Well, she's a fun character to write. I mean, a lot of people have different ideas about who would play her in the movie. I always see her as Katie Sackhoff.
Oh gosh, yes.
And having, I had the fortunate opportunity to meet Katie at a Battlestar Galactica convention that a friend of mine was running, and we hung out in the green room for a while and had a chat. And she's completely not like Starbuck at all in real life. She's a very funny, very sort of bubbly person, totally not kind of grim and hardcore like Starbuck is. And I can remember when I was saying the stuff for Vale, I kept thinking back, okay, I'm imagining Katie playing this, and I'm imagining her doing her Star Trek thing and playing it in a different kind of way. And she has that kind of lighter touch. But she's still, I still think of Vale as she's an ex-cop, and she carries that cop swagger with her wherever she goes, and that's how she sort of perceives the world around her, that she has that close eye on things, but she's kind of cynical but a little cocky with it as well, and I really like that, and I thought, again, okay, what am I going to do? I'm going to take her out of her comfort zone. And I'm going to put her in a situation that she's not 100% happy with, that she thinks, well, maybe I can handle this. I'm not quite sure. The only way I'm going to find out is if I test myself. And, she's basically put in command of a starship and told, go off and do this. And she has her own kind of little subplot to deal with there, where she's searching out Bashir to find out what happened to him after the end of of Dave's novel. And that was fun to take on. Dave, you know, Dave puts him through the ringer. Poor Bashir, poor Julian.
Oh, gosh. No kidding.
And of course, I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to go over that again. I didn't want to, you know, Bashir's in the story and he plays an important role, but he's not a main character. And I didn't really want to kind of push him front and center and go, okay, he's been through the ringer once and here he goes again. But there were important things that, you know, there are definite beats that need to be hit to make the story come together. So, you know, we get to see a little bit of Ezri Dax dealing with the situation that she's come out of, and we get to see a little bit of Julian, and they have kind of small spotlight moments, but I think that they're important turning points that the main narrative of the novel kind of orbits around. And it was fun to, you know, do this. Another thing that's great about writing something like The Fall is, although it's ostensibly a Titan novel, I did get the opportunity to drag in characters from other shows and do cool stuff with them. I've written my Terek Nor novel was ostensibly a DS9 novel, but it didn't really have many DS9 characters in it. And so this was an opportunity for me to you know, write a little Ezri and a little bit of Nog and a little bit of Bashir, you know, and that was all good fun too.
Yeah, it's something that I think in these stories has just been working really well, how, you know, when you take the 24th century and you bring everybody closer to home, you know, they would start, you know, interacting with each other, especially with the places that they're in, you know, a Riker, you know, being the kind of captain he is, the captain that Ezri had become, you know, obviously who Picard is in the Enterprise. And then of course, you know, where Sisko is and the respect that people have for him. And you put all these big events and of course they're going to be a part of it. And so I'm definitely interested to see just what Dayton does in the end and how he wraps it all up, you know, with Riker and Picard. And then, of course, you know, we still have some dangling threads there of you know, what are they going to do with Ezri and, you know, all of this kind of thing. It's just fantastic. And so, oh, goodness, really am on the edge of my seat waiting for what happens. But, yeah, I mean, this book, you know, when the Andorians come to Julian's rescue, I wanted to stand up and cheer, because finally something good happened to him. You know, I mean, Dave had really put him through the ringer, and then obviously, you know, he's in this Black Ops Starfleet cell that hardly anybody knows about. You're pretty sure he's just going to disappear, and then, you know, Deanna, with the help of the Andorians, comes to the rescue, and it was awesome. So it makes me really excited, because I know David's writing Declassified next year and what he's going to be doing with Julian there. And so I just, oh man, good stuff.
That was the whole kind of subplot with Deanna there, and you know, sort of like being tied into what Vale was doing is I wanted to give Deanna an opportunity to do something cool, and but definitely something that would remain kind of in her wheelhouse. So, you know, while Riker is kind of doing his shoulder forward walk stuff, you know, Deanna's kind of coming at it from a different point of view, is an empathetic point of view. She's like, okay, I know what it is to be a diplomat. I know how to game the system. And here's a situation that I don't like, is how am I going to use all of my talents? How am I going to game the system in order to kind of, you know, help Bashir get out of the situation that he's in? And Vale says, well, look, I've got this piece of information. Can you make this work? And Deanna's like, yeah, I got this. No worries. You know, and I was really pleased about having an opportunity for her to kind of be a diplomat, to do what she's there to do on Titan, but in this situation, in the heart of the Federation, rather than dealing with like a first contact or something like that. This is kind of traditional diplomacy in the true political sense of it. So getting her to kind of like, you know, be able to stretch her legs a little bit in that was fun. And I like the way it played out. I really enjoyed some of the scenes that I had the most fun writing. It's like where Vale and Deanna are interrogating the guy in the cell, and they're doing almost like a kind of good cop bad cop routine with this guy, and then it becomes kind of bad cop worse cop, and that was really fun, because I could just imagine those characters kind of playing that off. And you know, there are times sometimes when, you know, when you it's like a real gift being able to write these characters that, you know, I've lived with for so many years that have been great fun for me and have given me a lot of enjoyment, and then having the opportunity to kind of put them into a situation and say, let's have these guys just run around and do some cool stuff, and getting to write that, it's just it doesn't even feel like work, which is great. Don't tell my boss I said that though.
Oh, I wasn't recording then. That's not on. Yeah. That's not on the podcast.
No, it's all really, really hard work. I deserve all the money I'm paid. It's like, oh, it's like getting blood out of a stone. It really is.
Well,
such a chore. But I was going to pick up on something else you said about Section 31, because you mentioned that earlier, and I didn't say that. Is we talked about Section 31 being the kind of the boogeyman, and you know this they are the personification of the dark side of the Federation, you know, then not in a kind of mirror universe kind of shouty way where they're using their agonizers on people, but in a much more insidious way, you know, that they are the Federation kind of pushed too far down the dark road. And I know we did talk about how much Section 31 would be involved in this story. And in the end, I think it was definitely a kind of conscious decision on everybody's part that they would not be players in this narrative in a large sense, that it would not be, this is a Section 31 plot. Because I think in a way that kind of feels like it's done. That yeah. We've been there. And certainly, you know, there's...
With Star Trek and the Darkness.
Definitely, yeah. With that was very much in the kind of consciousness and the thing, you know, the movie hit a lot of those beats. We don't really want to do the same thing. We want to try and take it in a different way. But the idea of Section 31 kind of... Oh, they're totally there all through this story. You know, I think their influence kind of marbles it. And in a way, I can just imagine those guys. They're just sitting off by the sidelines and going, well, we're just going to see how this plays out.
Yeah.
You know, we're not going to interfere. Because Section 31, you know, if it goes one way, they'll be able to handle it. And if it goes another way, they'll be able to handle it. Because that's the kind of guys they are. They've got a contingency for everything. And I think that's what they're doing as the fall plays out. It's like, oh, this thing happened. Okay, well... how does that affect us? Well, it does this and this. Okay, well, we're just going to sit here and we're going to watch.
Mm.
And if this becomes a threat to us, that's when we're going to step in. But right now, they're just letting it. They're going to let it ride and see how it plays out. And it'll be interesting to see if you know, Dave picks up on that with Declassified too.
Well, it was kind of scary in the sense that you know, it seemed like when they were used, they had more. Value to what they were doing in helping Julian and their desire really to see the Federation and its ideals go forward than, say, the president at the moment. I mean, that was, I think, the scariest part of the series for me so far, is that Section 31 seemed more legitimately good than who the president of the Federation was at this point. And that was scary.
See, that illustrates very much the, you know, the nature of when you're somebody in a position of power and you've come from a place where you've been injured by war and it's affected and it's changed your mindset. You maybe lose the perspective, you know, lose the ability to kind of think, is there another way that doesn't involve violence and hardship? You know, is there a solution to this problem which does not involve me drawing my sword? And it's the, you know, if the only tool you have in your toolkit is a hammer, pretty much everything starts to look like, and you know, and that's the situation that we have with Ishan, the president pro tem, is a guy who only really has a hammer, and that's why he's seeing things in this sort of light, you know, and he's a hawkish guy. He thinks this is the solution, you know, he thinks this is the way to solve all the problems that they're having, and he doesn't see it from other people's point of view. You know, that's the whole scene at the end of the story where Riker basically kind of calls him on the carpet about it, and it's almost like Riker's, in a way, it's Riker's declaration of war to this guy.
Oh yeah.
He says, you know what, you know, again, it's like in a way, you know, like Picard's kind of like, the line must be drawn here speech, you know, it's like, it's Riker's own take on that. It's look, I know what you're doing and I'm going to stop you, and you know, and maybe even in a way he's kind of giving him the opportunity to kind of look, you know, you're on the brink here. Do you want to be like Min Zai for, you know, the other politicians in history who are known as being, you know, guys who made the wrong choice? Is you've got an opportunity here not to do that. And I'm telling you, this is wrong and people aren't going to stand for it. And he doesn't hear him because he's not listening at all. He's just like, you know, yeah, you've come into this room to just kind of shout at me and I'm not listening because I know I'm right, because he's not even going to consider the fact that he's wrong.
Yeah.
And that kind of villain is always the hardest to beat, because they don't see themselves as the bad guy. You know, Ishan sees himself as the hero of the story. and how that plays out is going to be challenging for our characters to deal with.
Well, and it I think, again, it leaves all of us on the edge of our seat, just, you know, waiting for what Dayton is going to do. And I know he will just wrap it up splendidly, but definitely can't wait for the next couple of weeks for that to come out and then be able to dive right in.
Actually, the truth is Q solves it in the first 10 minutes, and then the rest of the book is more on vacation at Risa. There you go, I've spoiled it.
Oh, well, I mean, you know, it's great because I feel like these characters could really use a vacation. Yeah.
I think we should definitely, at the end, I think, you know, like maybe for an ebook release would be just kind of like they go on holiday to the hot springs or something and just, you know, it's just like everybody has a chill out and relax. It's like, hey, war's over, guys, you know, let's all just cool down.
That would be really funny. I can't imagine, you know, well, and at this point too, you got the Rikers with their kids, the Siskos with their kids, the Picards with their kids, you know, so you've got all these families, and then, you know, you could add in all the other characters that are our favorites and just, you know, let them have a great time.
Well, you know that Quark would be hiring out his staff as like babysitters and stuff like that. You know, finding that would be a lucrative opportunity for him, definitely.
Right, you know, he'd be hiring out Davo girls as babysitters. Okay, well, James, I was looking and I didn't see you at least right now signed up for a new Star Trek book in 2014. Please tell me you do have one in the works.
We are discussing not one, but two Star Trek books.
Yes, excellent.
No inks on contracts, nothing's cast in stone yet. But I have put together an outline for a TOS novel. So kind of five-year mission era, what I always think of as the kind of, you know, the yellow, red, and blue tunic sort of era of Star Trek, you know. Because I'm a dyed-in-the-wool classic Trek fanboy, definitely so, you know, and it was, you know, it's my first fandom, my first great love in sci-fi. And although I got to write kind of in the classic Trek era when I did Cast No Shadow, that was more the kind of movie era, what I always think of as the maroon tunic kind of era of Star Trek.
Ah, great uniforms.
You know, and I've always wanted to do something that kind of harks back to the sort of the widescreen Technicolor era of the original Star Trek, you know, something that feels like the big bombastic brassy stuff that we would
right.
see, and then, you know, and the kind of crazy stuff they did in the animated series, all of that, you know, I've got a lot of love for that. So I have an idea that I'm kicking around for that, but right now we haven't scheduled it, and beyond that we're talking about the possibility of another Titan novel, but that's, again, it's all kind of very early days right now. We're all
excellent.
Just sort of like trying to figure out what will work well and in terms of scheduling, because right now my schedule is kind of crazy busy and we're just trying to find the opportunity to sort of slot everything in.
Oh, good.
But I'm certainly, however it shakes out, whether it, you know, whether it's those projects or whether it becomes something completely different, I have not any desire to stop writing Star Trek stuff because it's just so much fun for me. It really is like putting on a pair of comfortable shoes and just easing back into it, you know, because I love this universe so much. It really feels like coming home again every time I start writing a Star Trek story.
Well, the last thing that I love to do is just tell everyone what's coming out for you. What do you need to tell the listeners that they need to be going to get that's yours? And, of course, where can everybody follow you?
Okay. Well, right now, towards the end of the year, I'm doing some stuff for Black Library for the Warhammer 40,000 series. We're having this advent calendar all through December, and we're releasing kind of little ebook short stories, and I'm doing a couple of short stories for that. What else? Let's see. I have a top secret tie-in project that I'm working on right now, which I can't announce, but I'm hoping to talk more about that in the new year. It's not a science fiction project, something completely different. So keep an eye, and I'll be able to say more about that hopefully kind of January, February. And I've just done a short story called Turn of the Card for a giant monster anthology called Kaiju Rising, which is coming out from Ragnarok Press this month. And that was huge fun. That was basically me writing a Godzilla movie set in London in a short story. And having thoroughly enjoyed watching Pacific Rim earlier this year, that was an opportunity to kind of, you know, play with that. And I had a great time putting that together. So that'll be due out soon. In terms of where you can find me online, I have a blog, and that is at jamesswallow.blogspot.co.uk. You can find me on Twitter at @jmswallow. And I've just recently started up a Tumblr account where I post pictures of interesting clouds or anything cool that I've seen. And that's jmswallow.tumblr.com. So you can get hold of me anywhere there. And I'm always open if anybody wants to ping me on. I sometimes post on the Trek BBS site and a couple other places. So always open to chat to people about Star Trek, because you know, it's fun and it's what I do.
Awesome, James. Well, thank you so much. I know it's late there for you, but I really do appreciate you taking out your time talking to me. It's so much fun to get to talk to you about Star Trek, because honestly, I think we could just talk for hours, because there's always another tangent to go on.
My pleasure, man. It's always fun to come on the show, and you guys keep up the great work as well, because I'm a regular listener.
Oh, thank you.
Of course, I have to now and then. I have to skip over stuff because you know you're reviewing issues of comics that I haven't read. But it's always fun to see you guys getting into it. And I can certainly say on behalf of all the Star Trek writers, we really appreciate your support and the support of your listeners and the readership too.
Well, it's definitely our pleasure, and I hope that you have a great night and a happy holidays as well.
You too.
Well, Matthew, once again, another great interview with James. I'm really sorry I wasn't able to join with the way the time zones worked out, but I really enjoyed listening back as I was doing the editing. And, you know, you're a bit of a celebrity, I think, now, Matthew, aren't you? I understand there's a little hidden Easter egg in the poison chalice related to you.
Well, Chris, there is. So on the other side of the page, James and I were talking, and he was talking about how he named a character in the book after a friend of his. And I was just thinking out loud. I was like, man, that would be so cool if somebody did that. And he goes, well, I actually did. I named a ship after you. You didn't catch that? I was like, what? So he takes me to the page here. And apparently there is this awesome Andorian ship, this Attler class escort cruiser, the ADS Matt Russ. And he named it after me.
That's awesome.
Yeah, which even cooler though, Chris, he said he was listening to our show. We were talking about some Andorians and some comics, and he was like, I should name that ship after Matt Rushing. So, yeah, so cool to be a part of, you know, literary history, a New York Times best-selling book. I love it.
That's really, really awesome. Very awesome. Thanks, James. That's great. So I bet there are a lot of fights taking place on that ship, though, aren't there?
There's a ton of fight scenes going on that ship, you know. But, hey, it's an Andorian ship, and personally, blue-skinned women are just fine with me. So this is fantastic.
Think of all the great ale that you get to drink also.
Oh, my gosh, Andorian. That's right, Andorian ale. I mean, this is just getting better and better.
All right. That is really awesome. Well, that was a great interview, as I said, but it's not the only thing we've been discussing on the network this week. So here are some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
The unmade Starfleet Academy movie.
You know, even on paper. Okay, do we want to do the script which was written by the guy who wrote Star Trek V, or do we want to do the script which was written by the guy who wrote Star Trek II?
Earl Grey.
The ships of TNG.
Oh, no, it's one ship that splits into three parts, just like the D is one ship that splits into two parts. It's not a Voltron, it's one ship.
An owl formed the saucer.
The orb.
Dr. Bashir, I presume, commentary.
I know that.
It's just awesome.
The look on Sisko's face the whole time, he's just looking at Zimmerman like, all right, you're a piece of work, aren't you?
Exactly.
To the journey!
Seska.
And obviously Seska couldn't let go. No. And she proved that by having his child against his will.
Yeah. Now here is the Maury Show twist of the future. He does not impregnate her. She impregnates herself with his DNA, or so she thought. But he is not the father.
The ready room.
The ship.
but it's also really gloomy, and it's sad. I never want to go back there. I don't want to like re-experience that. Like just the visual candy of being able to go outside and talk to the Vorta. And wow, I maybe didn't phrase that properly. I meant the change in color and lighting. Oh. I did not mean. But she's a very attractive
I thought you were
Vorta.
Talking about Kiana.
She is fetching. No? She's a fetching lass.
Warp 5.
Zindi Evolution.
Well, I think maybe Okapa and Insectoid are two races that could have a life together. You know, you've got the 9-year lifespan of the Okapa. You've got the 12-year lifespan of an Insectoid. If they meet at the right time, it could be a beautiful love story.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Iris Stephen Bear's Star Trek.
And it's the first time I heard him say something that he said several times over the years is, you know, one day when we're not the middle child, we're not the stepchild, people are going to go, holy crap, look at DS9.
Literary Treks.
Slings and Arrows, A Sea of Troubles.
You see in this book, too, that Picard is facing this melancholy because they've been worried about the Borg, and now the Dominion is on the horizon, and there's these two things, and obviously this is before First Contact, so that hasn't happened yet. And Picard seems to be kind of weighed down in this story in some ways.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and get your daily Trek Talk fix. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week, and some days we even have two shows, and you'll find them in a variety of places, including on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune, lots of ways for you to get our shows. So check them all out and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. And Matthew, if people have some questions for us or comments or thoughts on anything we talked about in news today, on ongoing number 28, Kenmore Conflict, and of course on James's book, The Poison Chalice, there are a variety of ways where you can send us your comments and questions. And that's by going to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Just choose to send to a show and choose Literary Treks. That will come to Matthew and me both by email. You can also send us a voicemail through the website, or you can go to our forums at trek.fm/forums, where there's a section for Literary Treks as well as one for books and one for comics, and you can talk to us and other listeners there. In social media, you can find us at Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and on Twitter, you'll also find us tweeting away all the time about Star Trek under username trekfm. And just drop us a line. We'd love to hear from you. And also, you know, if you like the show, drop by iTunes and leave us an iTunes review as well. It only takes a minute, and that helps other fans of Star Trek books and comics find the show as they're searching for podcasts, because it's not necessarily the easiest topic to locate with the plethora of listening options you have there in the iTunes store. Now, Matthew, when you're not commanding your own Andorian cruiser, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, you can find me on MattRushing02 on that official Twitter site for my command there on that Andorian vessel. Also, what's great is now that I have this Andorian vessel, I can start that wine service from Bajor. And so we should have regular shipments coming in that get that website up and running. So that's really exciting. So look for that coming soon. And then 2014 is apparently going to be huge. We also do the Orb, Chris, where we talk Deep Space Nine all the time. And I also have my own personal blog, 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. And I write about all sorts of different things there, movie reviews, just my own thoughts on lots of different things, other books that I read that aren't Star Trek, that kind of stuff. So, Chris, when you're not lamenting the fact that Yuki Sulu is a traitor, where can we find you?
Yeah, I was really disappointed in her. I don't know what I'm going to tell our parents.
Oh, man, that's going to be a tough combo.
Of course, Kirk told me, you know, just lie about it. So
yeah, well, I mean, he's good at that.
That's right. Yeah, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username, as well as on my personal website at cbrianjones.com. You can also find me elsewhere on the network besides doing The Orb with Matthew. You can find me every week on The Ready Room with hosts from all over the network, as well as special guests as we talk about Star Trek news and all 5 live-action Star Trek series. You'll find me on Warp 5, where we talk exclusively about Enterprise. And you'll find me on my interview show, Matterstream, where I talk to writers and actors and scientists and creatives and all sorts of people about topics loosely related to Star Trek. I got a couple of new shows recorded yesterday, in fact. have Alec Peters and Richard Hatch, who of course everyone knows from Battlestar Galactica, on to talk about their new project, Star Trek Axanar. Also talked to Dylan Nord from WeCare.com about the LeVar Burton efforts for AIDS research. So check those out as well. Also, Matthew, before we let everyone go, we'd like to ask you to please support our sponsors for this week's show. Your support of our sponsors makes it possible for us to bring Literary Treks to you every week. And first, there's Squarespace, the web's best hosting and CMS, that makes it simple for you to create a beautiful blog, website, portfolio, or an online store. Create your own space today. Try it free for 14 days. Just go to squarespace.com for your free trial and use offer code TREK12 to save 10%. Plus, choose the annual plan and get a free custom domain registration. Also, Matthew, there is Audible.com. Now, Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have time for. They are the premier source for audiobooks with more than 150,000 titles to choose from and new titles coming every week. Of course, there's classic books there. Current bestsellers are there as well. They have a lot of the most famous Star Trek books like Prime Directive, Federation, Spock's World, lots of TNG novels as well, lots of TOS novels from the numbered series. And those are narrated by many of the actors that you know and love from the show. And as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see how great Audible is. So give it a try today. Catch up on all those classic Star Trek books that you've yet to read or that latest novel from your favorite author. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. And that also helps us keep Literary Treks coming to you every week. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm. And we really thank Audible for their support of Literary Treks and the network. And lastly, there's one more way you can directly help us keep Literary Treks coming to you each week, and that's by going to trek.fm/donate to get our original alien illustrations. These are original artwork pieces done by Toba Ushi, who does most of the artwork that you see on our website. They're available as badges and as art prints, and you can mix and match. Choose which ones you want and which format. We have different levels of contribution that you can choose from as well. And your donations help us pay for the cost of production, hosting, and bandwidth that's needed to bring all of our shows to you each week. So we really thank you for helping us keep the network going. All right, so Matthew, it's been a great year on Literary Treks, and we would like to remind everyone once again, this is the last show for the year, and we're going to be taking a two-week break during the holidays, both for Matthew and everyone over there who are celebrating holidays at the end of December, as well as for me here in Japan, because the first week of January is our big holiday period with the New Year's. So we're going to rest up a little bit, and then we'll be back on January 12th with a new show. And we really appreciate you guys listening all year long.
Well, Chris, it is great that everybody's been listening to us and supporting us and writing reviews and all that kind of thing. We really do appreciate it. You know, I just want to say, you better watch out. You better not cry. You better not pout. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. So, yeah, you better watch out.
All right, you better. I thought you were going to say Santa Kirk is coming to town, but yeah. Santa Claus is going to be visiting a lot of people, too.
Well, Santa Kirk, I feel like, has a whole different reason for coming to town. most likely to visit Seven of Nine. But I just say,
Santa Kirk, I've never seen anyone carry around as much mistletoe with them as he does.
That is true. He carries a lot of mistletoe.
He really does. All right.
Well, until next time, live long and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.